I remember the night of the first Mardi Gras, meeting up with a friend in Oxford Street.
The Darkness police were very upset that we were there and wanted to know what the bloody hell that we think we were doing.
A lot of people were saying out of the bars onto the streets.
And then some people saw a whole lot of police cars going into King's Cross.
They were going to teach us a lesson and say that we would never come back on the streets again. It was the birth of our modern gay and lesbian rights movement in Australia.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappelle. Malaysia's press parrots the government's pathetic homophobia, rights advocates condemn Indonesia's anti-queer attacks, and 78ers recall the Sydney Mardi Gras' brutal beginnings. Those stories and more this week, now that you've tuned in to This Way Out.
I'm Wenzel Jones.
And I'm Tanya Kane Perry.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news interaffecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending February 17th, 2018. The continuing campaign against LGBTQ rights in Malaysia was marked this week by a leading newspaper publishing an article telling readers how to spot gays, and the government banning a scheduled concert by Hong Kong pop star Denise Ho because she's an out lesbian. Gay men, the Sinar Harian newspaper told its readers, like to wear tight clothes to show off their six-pack abs. They go to the gym to work on said abs, but also to ogle other men. The guidelines also claim that gay men adore beards and mustaches. Lesbians, on the other hand, enjoy hugging one another and holding hands and can be spotted by alert readers because they hate men and enjoy belittling them. Arwind Kumar, one of the country's biggest social media stars, wrote that, "I know a lot of really, really religious people who love keeping beards. Are you trying to say that they're gay? That's how stupid this is." The story was accompanied by an interview with Hanafiah Malik, a leading Muslim cleric, who warned that homosexuality was on the rise in Malaysia and that there was an urgent need to stop it. A still-in-effect colonial-era law punishes private consensual adult same-gender sex in the Southeast Asian nation by up to 20 years in prison.
The Malaysian government initially banned screenings of the hit live-action Disney film Beauty and the Beast last year after the studio refused to cut one scene suggesting that the antagonist's sidekick might be gay. And this week, one of Asia's most famous pop singers, Hong Kong's Denise Ho, was denied entry into the country for a concert in April in the capital city of Kuala Lumpur. 2,000 people were expected to attend. In a note on her Facebook page, Ho said that Malaysian officials suggested that her request for a work visa was rejected specifically because she's an out lesbian who frequently expresses her support for LGBTQ rights. Ho performed in Malaysia in 2006 without any issues. She came out publicly in 2012. "Everyone has the right to be themselves," she wrote this week. "We can be openly gay as someone else can be Christian or Muslim."
The United Nations Human Rights Commissioner and lawmakers from several other Southeast Asian countries this week condemned the continuing campaign against LGBTQ people in Indonesia. Officials used the country's draconian pornography laws to prosecute gay people because there are currently no statutes specifically making gay sex a crime, although proposed legislation now being considered would outlaw all sex outside of missionary position heterosexual marriage. Upping the ante, one Indonesian MP called this week for all gay people to be executed. UN Human Rights Commissioner Zaidi Al-Hussein said during a press conference this week in Jakarta that the hateful rhetoric against this community that is being cultivated, seemingly for cynical political purposes, will only deepen their suffering and create unnecessary divisions. "I hope the common sense and strong tradition of tolerance of the Indonesian people will prevail over populism and political opportunism."
A group of current and former regional lawmakers called Parliamentarians for Human Rights, an offshoot of the influential Association of Southeast Asian Nations, is urging Indonesia's House of Representatives to reject the bill they are now debating that would criminalize same-gender and premarital heterosexual sex. Filipino MP and PHR member Teddy Bagulat said that, It is extremely worrying that private affairs between two consenting, law-abiding adults could very soon be opened to government interference and scrutiny.
The situation is even worse in the Indonesian province of Aceh, which has special permission from federal authorities to govern under harsh Islamic law. Aceh was the site of the notorious 82 lash canings of two young gay men in the public square last year, and most recently of police raids on a number of beauty salons that detained and publicly humiliated at least a dozen transgender beauticians and customers. The Aceh government this week announced that any beauty salon owned by a transgender person or employing transgender people would lose its operating license. It's a sign of how inhospitable Aceh is now perceived to be that less than 200 competitors have signed up for the upcoming annual Aceh Marathon. Tourism officials had expected 4,000 runners. Aceh Governor Irwandi Yusef admitted that the lack of enthusiasm might have something to do with the way his government treats LGBTQ people.
A new marriage equality lawsuit was filed this week in Bermuda. A gay Bermudan man, 38-year-old Rod Ferguson, is challenging the recently enacted Domestic Partnership Act 2017 that was belatedly signed into law by the British Overseas Territories Governor John Rankin last week. That measure, passed by Bermuda lawmakers in December, overturned a May 2017 Supreme Court marriage equality ruling and allows same-gender couples to only enter into domestic partnerships. The government claims that domestic partners will have all the rights of married heterosexual couples, but critics around the world disagree. Ferguson's lawyer, Mark Pettingill, announced the new legal challenge this week. He represented the gay couple that successfully won the Supreme Court marriage equality case last year. He's also Bermuda's former attorney general. Pettingill told reporters this week that his native Bermudan client currently lives in the United States and has a boyfriend. He would like to have a family life, but with a partner of the same sex, he said. And his ability to do that in his home country, Bermuda, is not available to him. Rod became the person who was prepared to put his name out there and stand by his beliefs, he added. It's very courageous. Pettingill said the legislature's unprecedented revocation of court-ordered marriage equality violated the island nation's constitutional guarantees of freedom of association and equal protection of the law. In Bermuda, same-sex marriage was legal, and then we took it away, he explained. The real significance is that it is the removal of an existing right.
Donald Trump's Education Department made it official this week. The agency will not consider bias complaints lodged by transgender students simply seeking to use campus bathrooms that match their gender identity. Discrimination complaints by at least four different transgender students were rejected by the Education Department last year. That policy has now been made official. It shed another Trump reversal of an Obama-era initiative. Obama's Justice and Education Departments argued in several federal court cases that civil rights laws banning bias based on sex extended to sexual orientation and gender identity. The Trump administration insists that gender identity is not a protected category. Some transgender students are even forced to use separate facilities on campus, which stigmatizes and alienates them from their peers. But Elizabeth Hill, a spokeswoman for the Education Department, told BuzzFeed News that long-standing regulations provide that separating facilities on the basis of sex is not a form of discrimination prohibited by federal law. Senator Patty Murray of Washington State, a top Democrat on the Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee, called this week's formal announcement an unambiguous step backwards for civil rights in this country. Eliza Byard of the queer education advocacy group GLSEN described it as a cruel new policy. And the Human Rights Campaign's Sarah Warbelow condemned the move as reprehensible.
In the latest queer news out of the 2018 Winter Olympics in Pyeongchang, South Korea, bisexual Belgian speed skater Irene Wüst became the most successful speed skater in Olympic history this week by winning gold in the women's 1500-meter race. The 31-year-old athlete teared up when she realized that she had earned her record-breaking 10th Olympic medal. She's currently in a relationship with Dutch skater Letitia de Jong. Canadian Eric Radford became the first openly gay man to win a gold medal at the Winter Olympics when he and partner Megan Duhamel won the top prize in the team figure skating event. Radford was born in Winnipeg, Manitoba, and lives in Montreal, Quebec. He's engaged to Spanish ice dancer Luis Fenero.
The Olympian summer calling America's new gay sweetheart, 28-year-old figure skater Adam Rippon, won a bronze medal in the team figure skating event this week as part of Team USA. He made early headlines by rejecting a meeting with Vice President Mike Pence after he criticized the choice of the former Indiana governor and gay cure supporter to lead the U.S. delegation. At a recent news conference, Rippon addressed what some critics have called his flamboyance. "I can't tone it down," he said. "I've got so many messages from kids all over the country. I think as an athlete, I use this platform to my advantage. I think it's giving my skating greater purpose."
And finally, Rippon's friend and fellow Olympian freestyle skier Gus Kenworthy has the proverbial letter from his doctor to excuse him from having to meet Vice President Pence. He's echoed Rippon's refusal to go to the White House with other Olympians if they're invited. Kenworthy announced on Twitter late this week that he'd broken his thumb, showing the x-rays to prove it, but assured his fans that it won't stop me from competing, but it does prevent me from shaking Pence's hand. So, silver linings.
That's News Wrap, global queer news with attitude for the week ending February 17th, 2018. Produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Tanya Kane Perry.
And I'm Wenzel Jones.
I was actually terrified because I didn't know what was in store for us the rest of that night, where we were going to be taken.
It was a night like if you were there, you'd never forget it for the rest of your life. It was quite amazing.
Beatings and busts, not beads, at Sydney's first lesbian and gay Mardi Gras. But first,
Australian poet Dorothy Porter, coming up now on the Rainbow Minute. Brash, political, and sexy, Dorothy Porter breathed life into Australian literature. Born in Sydney, Australia in 1954, she was hooked on words and language by age 14. After attending Sydney University, she published her first volume of poetry, Little Hoodlum. Perhaps her best-known work is The Monkey's Mask, published in 1994. This award-winning crime thriller about a lesbian detective made her a lesbian icon. Porter's works include 8 books of poetry, 5 verse novels, and libretti for 2 operas. She often wrote with music blaring to tap into the dark potency of rock and roll. In 1993, Porter moved to Melbourne for love. That love was Andrea Goldsmith, a revered author herself. They shared a home for 5 years until Porter's early death from breast cancer. The Rainbow Minute is produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns and recorded in the studios at WRIR in Richmond, Virginia, and read by volunteers like me, Pat Fishback.
If I were a frog, here is what I would say. It's hard being green. It's hard being gay.
Hi, this is Janice Ian, and you're listening to This Way Out. Support your local public radio station. You ain't gonna get this nowhere else.
Sydney, Australia can hardly wait for Cher to rain love and understanding down on this year's 40th anniversary lesbian and gay Mardi Gras. Events are already underway, and the world-famous Grand Parade and star-studded after-party are a far cry from the night of outrage against police brutality in 1978. That first Mardi Gras has been called Australia's Stonewall, the first time lesbians and gays fought back. But activists had been working since 1970, creating organizations like Sydney's CAMP, the Campaign Against Moral Persecution. CAMP pursued civil rights issues, planned protests and social gatherings, and most importantly ran a telephone hotline for people struggling to come out. Those early efforts prepared the political soil for the legendary 1978 Mardi Gras to take root. Eyewitnesses to the 1978 Mardi Gras melee vividly described their experiences in an award-winning 1999 documentary produced by Barry McKay, who's now a correspondent for This Way Out. It begins with Sydney Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence's Lesbian and Gay History Walk. Here's Mother Inferior at the area's famous King's Cross, or The Cross.
The Cross is also the site of one of the most important events in the history of the struggle for gay liberation, the 1978 Mardi Gras. The police raid on the march took place along the Darlinghurst Road strip in The Cross between here and the El Alamein Fountain. Here are a few of the original marches to tell the story of that evening. Lance Garland.
We thought that we should change the way the atmosphere at our demonstrations to make them more fun events, because obviously demonstrations in America were much more successful at attracting a wider section of the homosexual community than we were. Ron Austin, I think, suggested to a meeting at camp that we should have a Mardi Gras to celebrate Stonewall, as well as the political marches.
I remember the night of the first Mardi Gras, meeting up with a friend in Oxford Street. We had decided that we would join in celebrations. We weren't in fancy dress, but dressed in our usual gear.
Lots of people were in fancy dress. In the advertising, we'd told people that it was fancy dress, because it was Mardi Gras. Picking out people, knocking them down, resisting arrest as they're kicked on the ground. I got a police permit from Central Police Station. Unfortunately, they never notified the Darlinghurst Police that we would be having the demonstration, so when we were all assembling in Taylor Square, the Darlinghurst Police came over. They were very upset that we were there and wanted to know what the bloody hell did we think we were doing. And when I showed them the permit, it made them even more angry. Even with that anger, the feeling of the crowd was quite excited, and it was a joyous night. Everybody was so happy, and to be out in the street and dancing down Oxford Street with music that we loved, it was just a fantastic night. Read how disgusting we
are in the press. I marched with members of my household, and a lot of people were saying out of the bars onto the streets and getting people to join us. We had quite a lot of stunned onlookers, I might admit. It wasn't quite the scene you'd see there today by any stretch of the imagination. Sing if you're glad to be gay. Sing if you're
happy that way. Hey, sing if you're when glad the Mardi Gras got going, it was a fabulous sort of momentum to the evening. The truck was there with the music. We were marching along with a range of other people that we knew. We got down to College Street, and that is where we began to realise that all was not entirely well.
This big policeman who was doing most of the harassing, he started to hammer on the window of the truck with his fist, and he was trying to break the window. At the same time, another police officer was around the back of the truck, and he got to the batteries that were supplying the power for the PA system, and he disconnected the batteries.
By the bottom of Oxford Street, we had maybe 1,000 or 1,500 people. But then the police wouldn't let us go into Hyde Park and grabbed the truck with Lance Garland and some other people and took it away. So we had no central way of informing the crowd what was happening. And people were really hyped up and had been together for a very short time, and there was a sort of real threat of anticlimax.
The march took off up towards the cross. There was a general cry of up to the cross, up to the cross, because there was fairly spirited resistance to police stopping gay marches in those days.
But as we went up William Street, it turned more into a demonstration. You know, we didn't have banners and stuff, but we started to chant things, you know, like 2, 4, 6, 8 gays just as good as straight, and stop police attacks on gays, women and blacks, and so on.
There was no music, but people were still excited and skipping along, and young man ran past me and he called out, "I'll never hide again," as he flew past me through the air as he jumped.
And then, as we went to King's Cross, some people saw a whole lot of police cars going into King's Cross.
I do recall when we did get up to the cross and into Darlinghurst Road, marched down to LL Main Fountain, and then realised that the police were moving in on us and moving in en masse, and that was exceedingly freaky.
Once we got there, there was a very strange feeling in the air.
They were going to get us and they were going to teach us a lesson and say that we would never come back on the streets again.
The police came in and blocked off the Coca-Cola sign entrance, and paddy wagons came in and then came up and actually trapped the marchers in the middle.
And then all hell broke loose. The violence erupted. People began getting arrested.
And the police were being very violent, grabbing people by the hair, twisting people's arms up their back.
Yeah, I mean, people were being sort of picked up bodily and thrown into paddy wagons.
When they put people into the vans, they just didn't gently push them in. They threw them in so that they hit the back of the van with their heads or their bodies. You could hear the banging.
The police grabbed me by both arms and I was picked up, physically picked up, and then thrown toward the paddy wagon. I, by that stage, knew that I had sort of bruising, or felt that I was going to have massive bruising across my chest. The sleeve had actually been ripped right out of my leather jacket. And I mean right out. There was not a single thread still attached to the shoulder of my jacket at all.
The women and some of the men started fighting back and releasing people that were being arrested. And of course the violence was quite serious.
And it was just total and absolute mayhem. People were screaming, yelling, crying. There was every sort of emotion that you could possibly imagine.
It was like shooting fish in a barrel, basically. That was how it was.
It was just a roundup, like cattle. But the fight back continued, and when they'd open a van to throw someone in, sometimes five people would all jump out. And then the people who were standing around would grab the vans and try to tip them over. They were rocking them. It was a night like, if you were there, you'd never forget it for the rest of your life. It was quite amazing.
So I was pretty miserable by the time I got into the wagon. I was actually terrified because I didn't know what was in store for us the rest of that night, what was going to happen, where we were going to be taken.
53 people were arrested. And the police retreated down to Darlinghurst Police Station with the people they got, and they were quite brutal to many of those people, and kept people in, a lot of people in quite small cells, and were delaying releasing people. So people from the Mardi Gras then moved back down to Darlinghurst, and there was an all-night vigil to bail people out.
And I was in a cell with probably around 24 other women up at Darlinghurst Police Station. We were just herded in like animals. A few blankets were thrown in for warmth. The old Darlinghurst cells had virtually no heating. And there was a large bucket for us to drink from. And there was a lot of chatter, a lot of hugs, a lot of cuddles, a lot of reassuring, and also a lot of discussion about what was going to happen to us.
And we stood outside, hundreds of us, chanting out, "Let them go, let them go." Later on, of course, we heard that people who were inside, who were scared and being intimidated by the police, some were being bashed in the cells, could hear us outside chanting out, and that gave them a lot of support. They knew that, you know, they just weren't abandoned in the cells.
And it was that chanting and knowing that people were out there in support of us that I suppose offered some sense of reassurance that we were going to be as rescued or something was going to happen that wasn't going to keep us in those cells forever.
And a lot of the drag queens like Trixie, who knew what was happening in the Oxford Street and King's Cross venues, started raising quite a lot of money, and people rang their friends and everyone got their rent money, and cash started arriving there to bail out the 53 that were arrested. They wouldn't let lawyers or doctors in, and we knew that people were being beaten up badly inside or were badly injured.
And it was an amazing night to see all of this money that seemed to come. The people went around the bars collecting money, and everywhere it just came in, and everybody was bailed that night.
I was so relieved to actually get out of those, out of the police cell at Central, and several of my friends were down there waiting for me. Also, I do recall sort of people actually saying, was I hurt or had I been hurt? And one woman, Wendy, sort of taking photographs of the bruising which had already begun to come out.
I mean, really, people's names got published in the papers, people were sacked, people suicided, a whole lot of things like that, or at least one that I know of did.
It was the birth of our modern gay and lesbian rights movement in Australia, and I think it's great that it's grown like it has into this wonderful event, but I think it's really important that we understand that the reason why we have this Mardi Gras and this freedom today was because of that struggle that we took part in. Had we not fought back, had we sort of allowed the police to intimidate us and gone back into our closets, there'd be no Mardi Gras now, and we'd be just as bad off as we were back then. And I think that people should realise the history of the Mardi Gras and what it means politically to us.
Thank you to the original 78ers, Lance Garland, Sandy Banks, Diane Minnis, and Sister Mary Third Secret of Fatima, for sharing with us what it was like that night.
You can hear correspondent Barry McKay's original Sydney Gay and Lesbian History Walk radio series at historywalk.tripod.com. And you can take a History Walk via video with some of the 78ers who made the trip last year at thiswayout.org. Thanks for choosing This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. Program material this week came from Wenzel Jones and Tanya Kane Perry, produced by Steve Pride, from Pat Fishback, produced by Jed Proctor and Brian Burns, and from Barry McKay. Cher performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Ivana Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our individual listener donors who make this program possible. Look for This Way Out Radio on Facebook, Twitter, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and Google+. Smile at Overnight Productions on Amazon, email tworadio@aol.com, or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Lucia Chappell. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on WTND Macomb, Illinois, Free Radio San Diego, San Diego, California, Fresh FM Blenheim, Nelson, Tasman, Eastern Golden Bay, New Zealand, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Now, y'all, stay tuned.